This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
A lame duck president, a divided Congress, and next year's elections. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The House is adjourned for the year, but the Senate's still wrangling over defense and budget bills loaded with partisan controversies. Some Republicans are defying the White House. Vice President Cheney's rushing home from his overseas trip in case he's needed to break a tie. On To the Point, we'll update the action on Capitol Hill and see what's in store for the poor, the disabled, and the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. What about the Patriot Act? Will voters be more concerned about civil liberties or national security? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the FBI, terrorism, and lawful political protest. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. The House has adjourned for the year, but Vice President Cheney's rushing home from Pakistan in case there's a tie vote on important bills in the Senate. On To the Point, we'll hear about a divided Congress, a lame duck president, and next year's midterm elections. On Reporter's Notebook, why is the FBI keeping files on Greenpeace, the Catholic Worker, and People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals? First, this news update. In Pennsylvania today, a federal judge has ruled that intelligent design cannot be mentioned in biology classes as an alternative to Darwinian evolution. In fact, Judge John Jones says it's unconstitutional. Carl Tobias is professor of constitutional law at the University of Richmond, Virginia. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
How is it that this is unconstitutional, according to Judge Jones?
Well, the judge finds that intelligent design is not science, that it is creationism relabeled, and that basically it is an endorsement in effect and purpose of a religious point of view.
And that is unconstitutional, according to the separation of church and state?
Yes, under the First Amendment.
He also says that the defendants, the Dover Area School Board, lied about their motives. What's that about?
Well, I'm not sure he's saying that they lied on the stand, but rather that they may have said one thing in public and were thinking another when they voted in favor of this action by the school board.
So he's saying, as I understand, here's a quote from the decision, the purposes, secular purposes claimed by the board amount to a pretext for the board's real purpose, which was to promote religion.
Yes, and he makes extensive factual findings. He heard testimony for 6 weeks by both sides in this case, and the factual background is very thoroughly articulated in the decision.
What opportunities would there be then for appeal should the Dover Area School Board want to go to a higher court?
Well, they could appeal to the Third Circuit. As I understand it, though, the election in November totally changed the composition of the board, so it may be difficult. It may not be that there is a party who can appeal.
So, in other words, the board that made the decision to use what's involved here, let's make clear to our listeners, was that ninth grade teachers were supposed to read a statement at the beginning of class saying that Darwin's theory is not a fact, it has inexplicable gaps, and then the statement refers students to intelligent design and a textbook if they want to find out more information about that. The school board that ordered that is now gone, you're saying, has been replaced by the voters, so there might not be anybody left to appeal?
That's correct.
What about the impact on the rest of the country, then? It was thought that this would go a long way.
Well, I think it will go a long way, given the thorough, careful nature of this opinion by Judge Jones. I think in the past, in similar situations, one district opinion has carried quite a bit of weight so that it may dissuade other school districts nationwide who might be similarly inclined to adopt these types of programs not to do so.
Again, we're talking with Carl Tobias, professor of constitutional law at the University of Richmond in Virginia. How many school boards, to your knowledge, have already done this?
Well, I think there are a small number that actually have implemented anything of this sort, but I understand that a number may have been considering it, and this ruling may dampen their enthusiasm.
There's a statewide effort to do this in Kansas, is there not?
I believe that's the case, and then a number of districts in other states.
So you're saying then that they might be dissuaded from doing this. On the other hand, there might be some that would want to challenge it, get another district judge to rule. Judicial selections by plaintiffs are not unknown in these matters.
Exactly. Oh, well, actually, it would be by school boards. You know, they may do so in a federal district where the judges are considered to be more conservative, and perhaps it would withstand challenge. But as I said before, in the past, this has not been the experience. One comprehensive decision of this sort has often had nationwide effect.
So do you think then that the controversy may be over?
I doubt it.
Where would it pop up again, do you think, if it's not going to be by a school board around in some place in the country that wants to impose this kind of order?
Well, it may well happen again, but then I imagine there'll be plaintiffs who will challenge it, and so. But this decision, I think, will have very far-reaching implications, and I think is quite persuasively written. And so I believe other district judges may find it very helpful.
Took a long time to get to this ruling.
That's right. I mean, they had 6 weeks of testimony, and the judge labored over the opinion for, I guess, another month or month and a half.
And you mentioned that the Dover Area School Board's been removed and replaced since then by the voters. Nonetheless, this very conservative part of Pennsylvania.
Yes, and I understood it was very divisive in the community, that people who had been friends for a long time were at each other's throats. So that's unfortunate, too. And the judge comments on that, actually, in his decision.
So again, a very long and, you're saying, well-reasoned decision that might have a big impact elsewhere in the country.
Absolutely.
And an impact to put cold water, I guess, would be the best way to put it, on the idea of intelligent design being taught in the schools, at least as an alternative to creationism. Judge says he's not saying it shouldn't be taught at all.
Well, I think he's saying it's the equivalent of creationism, and I think
I meant as an alternative to Darwinism, of course.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Professor Tobias, thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure.
Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of Richmond in Virginia. In a moment, a lame duck president, a divided Congress, and next year's elections on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, we're not only back with To the Point. Congress has finished its business and adjourned this year's session, but the Senate is still wrestling with defense spending, the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve, cuts in social programs, and extending the Patriot Act. Charles Babington reports from Capitol Hill for The Washington Post. Charles, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
Big news today, the Vice President cutting off his intended visits in Saudi Arabia and other parts of the Middle East, coming back from Pakistan in case he has to break a tie vote. Explain the constitutional setup there.
Well, the Senate has 100 members. The Vice President is technically the President of the Senate, although you hardly ever see him here. He comes just to break ties. If there's a 50-50 or 49-49 tie, he can break the tie, and they're thinking that the probably the closest question that they're expecting either tonight or tomorrow is the question of a military spending bill, and the senator from Alaska, Ted Stevens, has attached to it an idea that's been kicking around a long time, and that is to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for drilling, for oil and gas drilling. So Stevens very much wants that. There's a number of a great majority of Democrats and some Republicans who oppose the drilling in the Arctic Refuge. And so there's going to be a showdown vote one way or another on whether that provision can stay on this bill. It's considered a must-pass bill.
A must-pass bill because it appropriates money for the Defense Department and for the war in Iraq.
Absolutely. So it's something that, you know, I was talking to John McCain, I and other reporters were just a few minutes ago, and he said he thinks it's disgraceful that this Alaska drilling bill gets attached to the spending bill. But at the same time, he said, there's no way I can vote against a bill that funds our troops.
On the other hand, Mr. McCain attached something to it himself, which, of course, had to do with torture.
Well, he's used the same game. You're absolutely right. This is a while back where McCain wanted to make sure that language was attached to some bill or another. At some point, one point, he had it on different things to make sure one of them got through that would limit the interrogation techniques that can be used by U.S. officials. I will hasten to add there that whereas the drilling in the Arctic is very divisive and splits Congress almost down the middle, McCain had overwhelming support for his torture amendment in the Senate and very strong support in the House as well.
And at least you would conclude that has something to do with defense spending, but oil drilling in the, in Anwar might, by some stretch of the imagination, have a connection, but there's also material or provisions in here for funding prevention for a flu pandemic, for cuts for $29 billion for Mississippi and Louisiana for hurricane relief funding, $3 billion for new levies. What's all that stuff doing in the defense spending bill?
Well, you're exactly right. Why it's in that bill is because the defense spending bill is a train that has to leave the station. So you want to attach your issue to that train because that's a train that has to go one way or another. And the only question is how many cars can get behind the engine. So you see this every year. It's a little more blatant, perhaps, this time, because as you correctly point out, these things clearly have nothing whatsoever to do with military spending. But the the way that the rules can be used in the Senate is that you can try to attach these things and see if they will withstand a challenge.
Now, the House has already passed this measure. Is it possible that the Senate could change it in any way? And if so, would the House then have to come back into session?
The full House, on something that's not terribly controversial, and I tell you, when you get close to Christmas Day, things you have to have a very high threshold to be controversial. The House is prepared to come back in what they call pro forma session Thursday, the day after tomorrow. And basically what that means is a handful of leaders could come in and pass something that there's not a lot of controversy about. So that would be a way, for example, another, we haven't mentioned this yet, but the extension of the Patriot Act, conceivably, if it's being held up by a filibuster in the Senate, if they modify it, let's say they just try to extend the existing law for 3 months, that would take House approval, but that probably would happen in a pro forma session with a handful of people in the House, and it happened so fast you wouldn't even know it happened.
They don't have to have a quorum then in order to do that. Just the leadership can take care of it?
That's right. Again, so long as there's not, I mean, if people object to it, then they're not. It won't happen. But this is something where everybody says, fine, be done with it and let's move on.
What about the budget and the cuts for poor people, for the disabled that have been so controversial, cuts in benefits for health care and so on? Are there Republicans in the Senate objecting to that? Is there any possible problem for the budget?
We expect a close vote on that. There are, yes, the short answer to your question, there are some moderate Republicans such as Olympia Snowe of Maine who do not support this. They think it's gone, that there's too many cuts along the type that you just described. Another moderate Republican in the Senate is Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, and I was talking with him yesterday about this, and he said, you know, sometimes you just have to hold your nose and vote for something. He said, it could have been worse. It wasn't as bad as I thought it might be. There's a lot of things in there I don't like, but you can't get everything, and sometimes you just got to let it go through.
Charles Babington, Washington Post congressional correspondent, talking about Arlen Specter, a man, of course, who's been a Republican, head of the Judiciary Committee, been very concerned about the recent revelations having to do with domestic surveillance by the National Security Agency. John Harwood is national political editor for The Wall Street Journal, and John, it's always good to have you on our program.
Hey, Warren.
What does all this say at the end of this session? Charles Babington explaining how all of a sudden rules that a lot of people have never heard before become very important, Vice President having to rush back and so on and so forth. But to some extent, this has to do with a breakup, it would appear, of Republican solidarity. But what does that mean at this point?
Well, the one thing that this White House has been able to rely on throughout George Bush's presidency has been very solid support from Republicans, both the rank and file around the country and Republican legislators in Washington. Now, one of the things that's happened as the president's political standing nationally has weakened, he's gone from being a 50% president to something less than that. Republicans increasingly, who know they're going to be on the ballot next year while he will not, are going their own way. But one of the intriguing things, right as we get to this end of session period, is the president's numbers are ticking up a little bit. And we saw a poll by Charles's newspaper and ABC yesterday showing the president at 47%. A week earlier, we'd shown him at 39%. So he's lifting up a bit, and maybe that gives a little more oomph to his arguments and getting Republicans together and saying, let's get a few things done before we go for the holidays.
On the other hand, the CNN USA Today Gallup poll shows that there isn't apparently an uptick for the president. So there would appear to be, at the least one would think, some confusion as far as voters are concerned.
Well, there is. But if you look at the average of all the major polls, he has come up a few points. He's still in a weaker position. He's still net negative on a lot of important indicators. How are you doing handling the economy? How are you doing handling Iraq? More people still disapprove of the president than approve of him, but he's a little bit better than he was a few weeks ago when he was really at a kind of a rock-bottom position.
So looking forward then, the next thing, big thing we're going to see after the Congress leaves, presuming that there isn't too big a change, is going to be the State of the Union speech by the president in January. How important is that going to be, do you think, as a milestone for his second term?
It's very important, and it's going to be fascinating to see what kind of agenda he frames for the country. Initially, his second term was going to be about a couple of big things domestically. One of them is Social Security reform. That's gone, and it's not likely to come back. Another was tax reform. He had a big panel commission looking at the issue of whether you can simplify the tax code, change it in a way to help the economy and make the system more fair. That report went over like a lead balloon among Republicans in Congress, people like Tom DeLay criticizing it. Now we see the administration downgrading that, lowering their sights a bit, looking at things like simply making permanent the tax cuts that the president has already gotten enacted. What could step up and replace those issues as a major domestic priority for the president? Health care is one possibility. Education is another. But we don't know exactly what the contents of those are going to be, and there's a lot of people in the administration working on the content of that speech right now.
Are there a lot of Republicans in Congress that want to have some input into that?
Sure they do. And I was talking to a Republican strategist on the Hill the other day who was saying, you know, it's not the time for big, ambitious goals. It's modest, achievable goals, which will try to rebuild our confidence with the American people. And they're looking at things like strengthening math and science education to make the U.S. economy more competitive with places like China and India that are rising very rapidly in global terms, things like passing some ways of making it easier for smaller companies to offer health insurance to people. If they can get some of those things done, the question is, you know, how large does a program have to be to make a real impact with the public? Remember, people used to criticize Bill Clinton for playing small ball with some of the small initiatives he used, but those things can have political usefulness. And remember, the one overriding priority of this president remains the Iraq war and trying to sustain that effort and bring it through to a successful conclusion.
That's obviously the 600-pound gorilla in the room, and if things aren't going well in Iraq, I would assume it's going to be very difficult for the president with the State of the Union or anything else to divert attention away from it.
You know, that's an interesting question, Warren. And it's something that is relevant for the moment that we're in right now. The president a few weeks ago launched this public relations offensive. Many people, myself included, thought that it would be difficult for him to move the needle in terms of public opinion because there was so much water under the bridge, so much had happened in the war. He's been the president now for 5 years. But they framed this around an election, which, as it was in January, turned into kind of a feel-good event about the war, and we are seeing some effect in the president's standing. Now, how much of that is because of the way they've talked about the war versus the fact of the election and that it was fairly successful? Hard to disentangle those two things, but certainly this is a good moment for them, and you know, the question is, how long can it be sustained? There was a similar lift last January from the first elections. Then the violence of the insurgency returned, and that fell back again. Is that going to happen again? We'll be watching that.
Well, now we have something, though, with regard to the surveillance issue that we haven't seen before, and that is some relatively senior Democrats, Barbara Boxer of California, John Lewis of Georgia, Mr. Conyers as well in Michigan, all talking about at least the possibility, using the word impeachment. How significant is that?
Well, there are elements of the Democratic base which have been encouraging members of the party to talk impeachment, and I think some liberals now feel that there is a pretext for that in what they regard as the president's flouting the law on these NSA intercepts. But it's an indication of how polarized this country is, because I've talked to people in the White House. They think this is a tremendous opportunity for them to appeal to public opinion, to use the same security issues that helped them with the public in 2002 on the Homeland Security Department, and that whole controversy helped them retake the Senate. And in 2004, when the president, in effect, came across as stronger on security than John Kerry, they are eager to try to engage that argument. And we saw some of that in the president's press conference yesterday. He pushed back very hard directly at Harry Reid, at Hillary Clinton, at Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein, California Democrats who had held up the Patriot Act, and sort of you lump those things together, the Patriot Act, the NSA intercepts, the treatment of detainees, and the White House is prepared to make the argument to the country, I'm going to be forward-leaning and aggressive in terms of protecting you, and they're the party that want to constrain my ability to do that. They think they can win that argument publicly.
And we've got the centrist Democrats, the Democratic Leadership Conference in particular, sending out a memo saying, let's not do anything to reinforce the image that we, the Democrats, are weak on security. That's a tough one for them.
It's a very tough one, and it's been a tough issue for Democrats for a long time. And, you know, this is the argument the White House makes, is that even if in some narrow sense they're winning an argument over the technicalities of constitutional law, and I don't mean to diminish it by describing it that way, but they think the Democrats are in the process of reinforcing long, durable impressions of their party as weak and equivocating on defense.
So, again, then, that sounds abstract to a lot of people. And when you're talking about American security and saving lives, I think was the phrase, one of the phrases the president used mm-hmm. yesterday, you got a pretty powerful issue.
There's no doubt about it. And I mean, this goes back a long way. You remember when the first President Bush attacked Michael Dukakis in the 1988 campaign, and some of his campaign staffers were saying that, you know, Mike Dukakis was a card-carrying member of the ACLU. Civil liberties arguments are not easy to sustain in a popular sense in terms of majority opinion.
Took people back to the idea of the card-carrying member of the Communist Party, which Joe McCarthy used to talk about back in the 50s.
You bet.
So again, as you say, a lot of these issues have legs. What about the problems that the president's having with the Republicans in his own party, especially in the Senate that we talked about earlier with Charles Babington?
Well, there's a lot of fissures which have developed within the party. Some are electoral, have to do with who's on the ballot next year and who isn't. Some are regional. Some are philosophical. The moderate Republicans certainly feel a lot more pressure and license even to step up and disagree on things like, what do we do on taxes and spending? Is it really the right thing to do to extend the tax cuts on dividend and capital gains at the same time we're cutting, we're making adjustments in the Medicare and Medicaid programs? Those disagreements are there. You also have disagreements with people on the right not liking the idea that the president wants this guest worker program, which splits social conservatives from the Republican business community. They want a guest worker program for people who come across the border from Mexico because they need them to fill a whole lot of jobs that Americans won't do.
Huge issue for next year. John Harwood, national political editor of the Wall Street Journal, thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure.
Going to continue this conversation in a moment on Reporter's Notebook. Is the FBI spying on political protesters? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point, once again talking today about a lame duck president, a divided Congress, and next year's elections. Andrew Kohut is president of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. It's always good to have you on our program.
Happy to be with you, Warren. How are you?
Earlier, before you joined, we were talking with John Harwood of the Wall Street Journal about polls, and he was saying that most of the polls right now, at least on average, show that the president does appear to have gotten a bit of a boost from his much-publicized efforts to sort of restore confidence in the war in Iraq. On the other hand, a Gallup today is showing that that's not the case. How solid is this uplift, do you think, for the president?
Well, I think you have to look at all of these polls, and they all suggest that Bush is a little bit above the nadir that he the nadir of his approval ratings that he found himself in about a month ago, and probably the consensus number, good news number is about 40% for Bush, which is not very good in absolute terms, but certainly better than 35%. I would give you the 40% a perspective on that. President Clinton had a 41% approval rating when his party lost control of the Congress in 1994. So Bush has gone as high now as President Clinton was when he really contributed to discontent with Washington and the end of the Democratic era in national politics up on the Hill.
Of course, Clinton was up for re-election again, and President Bush isn't, so there's less at stake for him. But that also leaves the Republicans who do have to be up for election next year in something of a quandary. What do we know about them around the country, and what are the prospects for Congress and the Senate?
Well, one of the things that we've seen in the national polls, the horse race questions about who you will vote for in terms of Republican or Democrat, show the Democrats with a bigger advantage than they've had in some time. And it's a long time out, and these polls don't test Senate races, but they do test national sentiment for the House. And they're pretty good at predicting seats. And if they ever held up at the levels that they are now at with Democrats with big pluralities in support, you would have a real dramatic change in the Congress, probably not only in the House but also in the Senate. But we're a long way from there. The bigger point is the Republican Party. The image of the Republican Party has come down with President Bush's approval ratings, and it's going to be make it very difficult. It's going to be a very very carefully considered relationship between the Republicans in Congress and the president, given if his level of even improved popularity remains where it is.
A moment ago, John Harwood of the Wall Street Journal said what we heard yesterday on our program from our commentator from the Los Angeles Times, that the White House is looking forward to an argument about national security, even if it features what Democrats are calling illegal, perhaps even impeachable behavior on the part of the White House, because that's an issue that really works for President Bush. Do you agree with that?
Well, when you change the conversation and you start talking about national security and terrorism, Bush is on better ground than when you're talking about domestic issues. And to a certain extent, I think there's some truth to that, but I think it would be very hard to only talk about these issues over the course of the next year. I mean, obviously, the controversy about the prisons in other countries for terrorist suspects, the NSA spying, these will be big issues that the president will deal with. And you know, he may not have as much political exposure as some might think. The public is willing to cross the line for the sake of national security to. And doesn't stand on principle to any great extent, but I can't believe that the next year is going to be debated about those issues mostly. We saw in September a tremendous change in public opinion, the first since September 11th, where the public was putting more emphasis on domestic issues than on the war on terrorism, and that was the first registration of that we've had since September 11th attacks. If that continues, President Bush will be not on comfortable grounds. There was a certain perverse truth to the fact that an argument about things that he may have done wrong might almost benefit him in the short run, because it's about an issue in which he still has the confidence of the public, but it can't stay there, Warren.
Andrew Kohut, president of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. Ross Baker is professor of political science at Rutgers University. He's also author of House and Senate, a comparison to the two houses of the U.S. Congress. Professor, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks, Warren. Nice to be here.
We just began this program by talking about the differences between the House. Congress has adjourned, and the Senate still fighting out, fighting on a number of issues with the vice president scheduled, if he's needed, to come back and break a tie. How important is that, do you think, at this moment in terms of the way the electorate perceives what's going on in Washington?
How important is
is a division among the houses, and the difficulty the president's having holding his own Republicans together in the Senate.
Right. Well, you know, I think that, that you really have to look at this sort of end of the session train wreck as a product of some larger kinds of forces. Number one, the subtraction of Tom DeLay from the majority leadership. I mean, he continues to function behind the scenes, but clearly Roy Blunt is now the person who's responsible. Secondly, in the United States Senate, Bill Frist is seen as someone who's just passing through. He clearly has presidential ambitions. He will retire from the Senate at the end of this term. And add to that a president whose approval ratings have been low. And I think you have a prescription for particularly Republicans who've been really very well disciplined, as one of the previous speakers said, for almost the entire period of President Bush's presidency, are now becoming much more footloose, much more concerned about their own electoral chances, much more concerned about how much of an asset the president is to them in their own reelection efforts. So you combine all of these things, plus any number of particular idiosyncratic items, and I think you've got the prescription for this particular sort of endgame mess that's going on.
A moment ago, we heard from Andrew Cohut of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press that if national sentiment stayed where it is, and of course he made the obvious caveat that that can change many times between now and November, but if it stayed the way it is, we might see dramatic changes even in the House of Representatives. And one would assume that means, despite the fact that there's been so much gerrymandering, that there are more safe seats than there are any that are usually up for grabs. Do you agree with that? Do you think that, in fact, the Democrats now have a chance of retaking the Congress?
Well, you know, I think one of the most favorite phrases of people who do public opinion polls is, if the election were held now.
Right.
But as Andrew Cohut pointed out, the election will not take place until next November. I think it's unlikely. And I think that certainly because of the gerrymandering in the House, Charles Cook, who writes the Cook Political Report, estimates that only at most 10% of the seats in the House of Representatives are in play. You're talking about 44 seats out of 435, and it would really take a national trend of colossal dimensions to wash away some of these highly entrenched Republicans. On the Senate side, there's another problem the Democrats have, and that is that that some of the seats that have been vacated are not necessarily strongly in the Democratic column. Particularly Mark Dayton's vacated seat in Minnesota. And, of course, in New Jersey, there's another situation whereby John Corzine, who has been the senator, was elected governor of the state, and he will take the oath of office on the 17th of January and be replaced by Robert Menendez, currently a House member and chairman of the Democratic Caucus, who is a somewhat controversial figure in New Jersey, largely because of his connection to the famous or infamous Hudson County Democratic machine. So those are just two examples of some of the problems that the Democrats face. The Republicans have their own set of problems. Senator Conrad Burns of Montana, having taken a substantial amount of money from the lobbyist Jack Abramoff, which he has returned, and that's something that no one has spoken about yet, and that is a scandal that is metastasizing at warp speed. You have already had one arrest associated with it, a White House official, but you've also had an indictment of one of Abramoff's associates. And the expectation is that he will roll over on Abramoff, and Abramoff will in turn roll over on members of Congress. So in terms of what the Justice Department is looking at, is they're looking at a number of very high-profile Republicans who may well be embarrassed by this.
Again, Professor Ross Baker teaches political science at Rutgers University. Back to Andrew Cohut with the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. You indicated very strongly that things might well change a lot between now and the next election. What would it take to provide the sort of colossal national trend that would alter the makeup in the House of Representatives, particularly? And does this scandal involving Jack Abramoff, of course, very much associated with Tom DeLay, offer the possibility of such of getting to that dimension?
I don't think you have to go too much further than where you are now. I mean, if President Bush's approval ratings are at 41% on average in the national polls, you're going to see, and to put in the professor's word, a national trend of colossal consequence. This state by there is now surely there's more safe seat redistricting than there's been in the past, but we've seen the number of competitive seats rise and decline over the course of the years. In 1988, there were almost as few competitive races as there were in 2004. 2 and 4, and 6 years later, there were many more. That can, the number of competitive seats is a function of the climate of competitiveness, and the president, if he sustains a 40% or lower approval rating, the Republicans are going to have extraordinary problems. And I would add that the national polls, as opposed to the seat-by-seat analysis, were very prophetic in predicting the Republican trend in 94, when the people who go on a seat-by-seat basis couldn't see it because the trends are when a race gets nationalized, it's hard to pick it up by looking at individual races. And even Charlie these days says the levies are pretty strong, but not strong enough to hold hold back a real tide. And I don't think you need to have many more problems than Bush now has with this kind of approval rating. In every midterm election where a president, or second term election where a president's approval ratings have been low, his party has lost seats.
Andrew Kohut, back to Ross Baker at Rutgers University. What about some of the issues that are going to be discussed? Do the Democrats have any leverage if there's concern about domestic issues, arguing that there have been too many cuts in social programs and accompanied by tax cuts, with even Olympia Snowe, Republican from Maine, taking that position?
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting that to look at the whole question of the economy as a whole. And, of course, you know, there have been over the years some very elaborate predictive models set up by Professor Tufte of Yale, among others, who look at things like disposable income, who look at inflation and so on. And you look at some of those indicators, and they look pretty good for the Republicans. And, of course, you know, it seems to have passed into political folklore that the economy is the one issue that really does cause people to vote one way or another. So I think that's something we really have to consider, as well as Iraq, as well as the civil liberties questions and so on. And, I mean, I think that certainly, you know, the Democrats are taking something of a risk, for example, in filibustering the USA Patriot Act. I think that
even though they have Republicans on their side,
I think that I don't know that the Republicans on their side are enough to give them the cover that they need. I mean, certainly there are there are Republicans who are concerned about it. I'm not sure that that Larry Craig and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska are necessarily people they want. More problematic, I think, for the Democrats, of course, is the defense appropriations bill. I mean, that's one in which I think John McCain's reaction that you just can't vote against this bill is probably a pretty solid advice. And I don't know that the Democrats necessarily want to want to sacrifice themselves over Anwar. It is possible, for example, that even if Anwar were the drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge were approved, that it wouldn't then become bogged down in litigation by environmentalists. So my sense is that many Democrats are wondering whether or not this particular issue is worth a filibuster against the legislation which will provide body armor and Humvees in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Russ Baker at Rutgers. Back to Andrew Kohut with the Pew Research Center. Interested in your take on all of those issues and also the question now raised by several Democrats using the word impeachment, referring to the allegedly illegal spying by the National Security Agency. How do you think these things are going to play?
Well, I think that the public, a lot will depend upon the specifics here. I mean, I think that the public will look the other way if they get a sense that, you know, the kinds of people that the NSA was spying on were probably high-risk characters given what they were doing and who they were associated with overseas. You know, I just, doesn't have the earmarks of something like Watergate, where people feel that the civil liberties with the, I'm harking back to the enemies list of journalists and political opponents were being called into question. I don't think that will be the case. I think there would be a backlash against impeachment. On the other hand, in terms of issues, I think Professor Ross's list is a good one, but there's one that's really very important, a practical, down-to-earth thing that really gets people going. That's gasoline prices. Mm. A lot of the movement in Bush's approval ratings were related to the spike in gasoline prices. We're at lower levels now in December. His approval rating has come up somewhat. This is a very big issue in the economies of ordinary people.
A lot of variables, I guess, is the bottom line here.
That's what they say in social science.
That's what they say in polling, and Ross Baker, that's what they say in political science, too, isn't it?
Certainly do.
Okay, a lot of variables, a lot to talk about in days to come, and thanks to you both for being with us. Ross Baker at Rutgers University, Andrew Kohut, just heard his voice, with the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. Good to have you both. And thanks to our earlier guests, John Harwood of the Wall Street Journal and Charles Babington of the Washington Post as well. The FBI denies any interest in monitoring political or social activities, but records show it has been watching and even infiltrating groups with causes including the environment, animal cruelty, and relief from poverty. Those groups, in turn, accuse the Bush administration of blurring the difference between terrorism and civil disobedience or lawful protest. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The American Civil Liberties Union has released some 2,300 pages of FBI files obtained under the Freedom of Information Act. They include records of surveillance on groups including Greenpeace, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and the Catholic Worker. Spencer Sue is reporting the story for The Washington Post. Spencer, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Warren. Thanks for having me.
These are highly redacted, which means a lot of the material is edited out. You can't read it. The ACLU says it's going back to court to try to see if it can open up the records further. But what are you able to see so far that indicates that the FBI is spying on people who may not be associated with terrorism, which, as I understand it, is the original reason for the surveillance?
That is certainly the ACLU's contention here, and it was the ACLU that unearthed these documents through a Freedom of Information Act request that was itself prompted last year when it was reported, or when it became known, that FBI agents were interviewing members of groups that planned to demonstrate at the political conventions. That raised this initial concern among civil libertarians that the FBI was somehow trying to suppress dissent. And they went ahead and asked for the papers on 150 domestic groups like PETA, Greenpeace, civil rights groups all over the country. The FBI will say that, look, we have no alternative but to investigate groups, even if they are involved in political advocacy, if we believe that they are somehow linked to the commission of a crime. We can't just wall off certain groups or certain organizations because of what they do. But what it does show is that, you know, there are voluminous files and that the FBI has spent a significant amount of time going and taking a very hard look at groups like PETA based on allegations that they may be connected to more radical or extreme or militant environmental groups that some of your listeners may have heard of, like the Environmental the Earth Liberation Front or the Animal Liberation Front, groups that have claimed credit for firebombings and other acts of violence against companies.
But they would be, I would assume, property crimes rather than crimes against individuals or groups of individuals that could be classified as terrorism, would they not?
That's exactly the you raise a terrific point, and that, I guess, is what the FBI and ACLU are fighting about now or arguing about now, essentially is a domestic equivalent to what has been seen more commonly in investigations of overseas terrorist organizations. At what point does an ordinarily mainstream political advocacy group, which expresses sympathy for, say, you know, a more extreme or violent, clearly defined or identified terrorist group, cross the line to providing illegal aid? That has been a question that has bedeviled investigations for, you know, groups that support, say, the IRA or Hezbollah or Hamas. And in this context, you know, the FBI claims that the director of the counterterrorism for the FBI this spring told the Congress that the single most significant domestic terror threat in the United States was these extremist environmental groups. They made the contention that they believe that these groups were, the traditional restraint from targeting people was somehow changing, although there wasn't a lot of detail to support that comment, and that in any case that, you know, some of these other groups that folks are more comfortable or more familiar with somehow may have, you know, provided legal support, or that there may be a lot of connections between individual members or participants in one group and people who may have supported or gotten involved with these more activist groups.
Talk with Spencer Hsu, the Washington Post staff reporter, about the FBI documents that the ACLU got under a Freedom of Information action, again, part of a lawsuit against the government for what it claims was improper interviewing and interference with people who wanted to participate in demonstrations at the political conventions last year. Well, what about the evidence that's in these documents? Again, as I understand it, they're very heavily redacted, as we say, with a lot of things crossed out. Is there any evidence that somebody from Greenpeace, for example, had any connection at all with the IRA or Hezbollah or Hamas?
Well, yeah, you're right. We shouldn't be too cavalier in making these comparisons. And it is very difficult. I mean, what you can to see specifics. What you can see from these papers is, for instance, an email from, say, July 2002, described as an electronic communication to the FBI's Counterterrorism Investigative Services from Canada. And the header of the email is suspicious activity with a nexus to international terrorism. And within that, there would be a case number that matches a case file that discusses Greenpeace. Now, the actual suspicion or criminal act or investigation is redacted. So it's very difficult to surmise or guess about this sort of thing. And no one is there's no evidence in these files that any of these groups, Greenpeace or PETA, have done anything wrong or illegal. And if anything, the ACLU would point out that some of the investigative techniques used by the FBI come close to chilling dissent or perhaps evoking or echoing practices in the 1970s when groups like the ACLU, civil rights groups, were heavily infiltrated, and that was what prompted the reforms that created some protections for against FBI infiltration of peaceful advocacy groups in the first place. Some examples, you can see cases where the FBI was recruiting interns at PETA or was trying to get information from people who were new to the organization. There was another case where there was a reference by the FBI to a source who was, quote, well-insulated within PETA and who was going to be attending a national convention in Washington to, better establish his credentials within the environmental community. There are references to, rosters of members and people attending meetings at, say, an Indiana University vegan community event. All these things raise a lot of sensitivities from these organizations, and as the ACLU put it, as PETA put it, this shows a disturbing erosion of freedom of association and freedom of speech that, as they put it, you know, that the U.S. has taken for granted that sets America apart from oppressive countries like the former Iraq, and they warn about going back to the dark days of Nixon and the enemies list.
ACLU says this, too, that in one document describing people involved in a protest against a missile defense test at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, there's a reference to the Catholic worker a group, which apparently was part of that, as semi-communistic. Are there those kinds of, I don't know what you call them, conclusionary descriptions about groups as well?
Yeah. I mean, it's not entirely clear who's writing, but yes, there are documents that refer to statements whose authors draw these conclusions, and it's not clear if it's from the presumably from the informant or from perhaps a an agency handler or agent, or even perhaps from discussions from other members with who might have attended, other non-government, nobody affiliated with the FBI who was attending these events. But they do say, based on the author's overhears in conversations with protesters, the Catholic workers advocated peace with a Christian and semi-communistic ideology. In another case, based on the author's interpretations of comments made by various CWG protesters, CWG also advocates a communist distribution of resources. And again, it's hard to, get a sense of how wide these views are held or who held these views, but obviously that does contain, as some of the critics are putting it, sort of McCarthyite whiff about that kind of observation.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. We'll find out more about this, I'm sure, in days to come. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks very much.
Spencer Hsu, Washington Post. Today's program produced by Christian Bordahl with Sherman Rembaum and Francis Anderton, Technical Director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.